From making the birds in your backyard happy to investing in the future of a wild place, this hour we'll talk about ways we can give back to nature. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. In this season of giving, we're going to spend the hour talking about what you can do to give to wildlife and wild places. We'll also talk about gifts you can give the humans in your life to indulge a love of nature. And we'll talk about gift ideas for kids that can foster an interest in wilderness or wildlife. And we want to hear your ideas as well. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with us today. And in this season of giving, we're going to spend the hour talking about what you can do to give to wildlife and wild places, and of course also to the people in your life who love wilderness and wild places. Hello, Jim.
Good morning. And boy, it is just incredible nights out there we've been having. It's last night I took my dog out before bedtime, and I heard this great call. It was a scream. First it was a whee! And then a Bart Owl right in the backyard.
Nice.
Greeting me for the evening. He was surprised that I had taken the dog out, I guess, and he decided to let me know about it.
Somewhat disapproving.
Yes,
well.
That's right.
Yes, well, it's nice that it's finally gotten cold and we're having some of those clear crystalline nights.
Yes, and a little bit of snow on Sunday. Folks farther in the northern part of the listening area, I'm sure, have tales of more snow than that. But we just had it in here in central Iowa, so not much, but it was nice. It was nice to have it white for a while. So.
Right, right. Well, yeah, so there was a lot of jealousy on this side of the state from
yeah.
from small children particularly.
I'm sure. No snow people in your front yard right now.
No, absolutely not. So this time of year, of course, we're spending a lot of time thinking about giving gifts to the people in our lives, and we haven't had a bad winter yet, so we don't see wildlife struggling with the cold or with lack of food at this point, but maybe that's coming.
Right, I think it will. The struggle is always there because, for example, rabbits, they have to change from that herbaceous diet of green growing succulent plants in the summertime to basically a woody diet in the wintertime. Deer have to do the same thing. And that transition is very, very tough. So the more things they have to choose, particularly palatable things that they have to choose from, the easier it is for them. And that leads to the first thing on my gift list for wildlife is a thing we call habitat. It's something we never have enough of. We never seem to have enough things to for wildlife to choose from. And in fact, as we talked about earlier this year, we seem to be losing it. For every step forward, we're getting several steps back because much of it is going into commercial production now.
Well, and I've seen more evidence of that just in recent weeks on the highways. I've
very
seen
true.
Trees being torn out and big bonfires.
Yeah, it's really been pretty sad fall that way from a wildlife standpoint, because all those fence rows that used to provide those wood lots that people left behind, even sort of the abandoned farmsteads, those are all being bulldozed and taken out and more put into row crops, and I think that's a very sad thing for Iowa's wildlife.
So, habitat, what can we do? I mean, you live out in the country, Jim, and you can turn your place into a paradise for wildlife.
Sure.
Not everybody has that opportunity.
That's right. But you do have many people, even if you rent, you do have a yard of some sort or another, and you can provide lots of things, even in a small way, for things on that property. First of all, you could plant some small shrubs. Even if you rent, sometimes the landlord, particularly if you're taking care of the yard, you can plant shrubs that are very, very friendly to wildlife. Things that fruit in the summertime, for example, are very good for nesting birds. Anything from some of the choke cherries or sarvisberry. There are lots of common names for that shrub. Any of those are really, really wonderful. Even raspberries, great for wildlife, in addition to being good for people. Things like dogwoods, viburnums, many of those provide fruit a little longer into the fall. Even nut-bearing shrubs like hazelnut are really, really wonderful things. Those are all native. The thing to think about, I think, when we're talking about habitat here is think native as much as possible. So how do you do that? Well, you can contact local nurseries or the State Forest Nursery and on their website, Iowa DNR, and plug in State Forest Nursery, and you'll come up with the location for it. And you can order wildlife packets and if you stay native, you won't be getting into trouble like we did so many years ago. I'm still fighting the honeysuckle that was planted by predecessors of mine on my property, or the buckthorn that's been brought in, or we won't be fighting so many of those things. So stay with native plants wherever you can. But providing that habitat is really a key. And we're not just talking about food plants. We can also talk about places to nest. So you can plant small groups of wild plum, for example, or dense shrubs, some of the evergreens like red cedar, or some of the spruces and pines even provide some really nice dense shrubs where birds can nest and mammals can find shelter.
How about feeding wildlife? I know that you're a big fan of bird feeders.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of bird feeders, but not for the reason that maybe that people think. Lots of times we think that we're doing the birds a favor, and we are in a sense, that it makes it easier for them to find feed. But really, it's about us. the real reason we feed birds in the wintertime is that we like to bring them up close and personal so we get a chance to see them. A lot of people around the state have been watching. This year we've had this big invasion year of pine siskins. The birds of the North Country, and we occasionally get a few down, but we're seeing flocks of 30, 40, and 50 pine siskins coming into feeders all at once, really dominating the feeders. Or we're seeing, a lot of people are seeing white-winged crossbills. We've got a pair at our feeders, even a few grosbeaks, pine grosbeaks that are just magnificent, or evening grosbeak, excuse me, and pine grosbeaks both are coming in. So people feed them to bring them up close and personal. Does it help them? Certainly it does. It makes it easier for them to find food. But would they survive without it? Indeed they would.
But you know, Jim, I have to think that it does help them. Not in the short term, but the closer that people are to wildlife, the more time that you spend getting to watch those birds, and then if your grandkids come over and they get to see the birds up close, I think that's a long-term investment.
That's a long-term investment. It certainly is. You're absolutely right. Yeah, it certainly does. I'm just thinking in terms from the bird standpoint. Could they find food? And my wife and I go round and round about this because she says, oh, my birds aren't going to, they're not going to be able to find food. Yes, they will. They'll find lots of wild birds to eat as long as there are other habitat areas out there, those weedy areas. The city here, we'll see cities cutting down mowing the weeds in the wintertime. Well, those are precisely the areas that these winter birds need to find the seed on the old seed, on the weedy seed heads that were up there. Things like ragweed have 25 to 30% protein in them. It's amazing amount of how much these weedy areas can provide us. So don't cut them all down. Don't mow them down to make it nice and neat. Leave them up for wild places for those wild birds. the feeding supplements that it does make it easier for them. And you're right. From a human standpoint, it brings them up close and personal so that we and our kin can see them and enjoy them.
You mentioned an invasion of pine siskins this year. Something that I've been seeing a whole lot of this year, are squirrels. Are we experiencing a giant squirrel population boom in
Iowa?
Well,
it was a very good year for them. They had an easy and good summer, apparently, and we have the same thing. We have lots and lots and lots of squirrels around. You know, the squirrel populations will vary from year to year. I'm not seeing, for example, or hearing, like I do in some years, a real heavy amount of mange on squirrels. I don't. A few years ago, there's a tremendous amount of mange. Mange is the disease of, it's actually caused by a mite that burrows beneath the skin, kills the hair follicles, and so the hair falls out, and it makes for bald squirrels, basically. And bald squirrels are in cold
very
winters,
vulnerable.
Very vulnerable, are usually dead squirrels. They won't last very long because it's hard for them to stay warm. So they die from exposure, and it's not a pretty way to go at all, that's for sure. But so we're not seeing that this year. So I think the lack of diseases and a very good breeding year for them meant, boy, there are a lot of squirrels around. And that's exactly right.
I've also been seeing a lot of hawks, and I thought maybe those two things are related.
Well, possibly. But I think the red tails are one of the few bird species that if you look at their national data for the last 35 or 40 years through their breeding bird surveys, they're one of the few species that has actually not only expanded their range but increased in numbers at rates greater than 1.5% to 2% a year. So they're doing very well. Red-tailed hawks across the nation are doing very, very well. What happens in mild winters, or mild early winters anyway, like we've had so far, is that they'll tend to hang around. As long as there's food to eat, they'll come north, and the ones that were farther north of us tend to hang around. There's not a lot of snow, there's plenty of prairie around. Why not stay here for a while? And so that's kind of what they're doing, and that's why I think people are seeing a lot of red tails around right now.
Well, definitely. I know I have. I just wondered if my squirrels might be related to that at all. But we do need to take a short break, and then we'll get back to this conversation. We're talking about gifts that you can give to wildlife and wild places. So we've talked about habitat in your own yard and things that you can do in your own backyard to give to wildlife. We're going to go a little bit bigger picture here when we come back in a moment. And we're also going to talk about gifts you can give to people in your life who love wilderness, and maybe some gifts you can give to kids to foster that kind of love and respect as well. And we'd love to hear your ideas. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here with me today. And we're talking about ways that you can give back to nature this holiday season. And Jim, before the break, like I said, we were talking fairly small picture, things that you can do in your yard, around your home, which of course can have a very big impact. Mm-hmm. But let's go a little bit bigger picture now.
Well, let me mention one thing that we didn't get to, and that's about bird feed, and that's still in your yard.
All right.
If I could only have one feeder, and only feed one thing, there's one thing I would buy, recommend for people to buy, and that is black oil sunflower seed. The reason being is it feeds the widest variety of winter birds. Probably 12 out of the 15 to 20 species that are here will feed on this. It attracts a wide variety of things and is highly nutritious as well. It's not a lot of waste. So if you're going to buy birdseed for some people, and this year, it's last couple of years, it's been pretty expensive, so it's a good present. I would get black oil sunflower seed, and just feeding pure black oil sunflower seed is the single most important thing you can do. The one thing I would say, however, a warning, and particularly this is true in these sort of mild winters, you get this accumulation underneath a feeder of, the shells of the sunflower seed, and then there, of course, there are the bird droppings that go in there. And in when we get these periodic warm days, when it gets above, you know, it gets into the 40s, that stuff literally starts to cook, and it cooks up a bacterial soup, if you will, particularly a bacteria called Salmonella. Salmonella is not good for birds, nor is it good for people. So what you want to do is, as it starts, if you get these periodic warm-ups through the winter, we have a very mild winter, clean up once a week or so underneath that feeder, get that waste seed and everything into a plastic bag and put it in the garbage or compost it in your compost heap, because it's not a good thing to leave there for the birds, and lots of birds will feed on the ground as well. Now, if you're thinking bigger, too, other things you can do in your own yard and your own properties, make sure that you could build a bird feeder or build a bird house. There are lots of species that need cavities to nest, and particularly in cities when we cut down lots of the dead trees so they don't fall down, there's a real a shortage of cavities for these cavity nesting birds. So you can go to the Extension website and pick up a publication called Shelves, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Squirrels. And there are lots of detailed plans in there about everything from, as it says, shelves, houses, and feeders for birds and for squirrels, from everything from bluebird houses to nesting cavities for kestrels and screech owls, that sort of thing. So it's some neat plans in there as well.
Sometimes I see a lot of like bat houses and things like that. There seem to be trends where something gets to be very popular for a little while. Are there any of those that just don't work that you would steer clear of, or do these plans tend to do what they're supposed to do?
Well, putting up a bat house is not like putting up a wren house. You put up a bat house, and the national statistics show that in 3 to 4 years, you might get maybe 50% occupancy if you put them in the right location, and you're lucky. So they're not. You put up a wren house, and it seems like the wrens discover it right away. They have phone lines to each other saying, "Hey, there's an empty one over here." But the bats are not the same way, and so people either put them in the wrong location. So pay attention to the directions about where, how high. No limbs below it, et cetera, so when they're mounted. But bat houses are fine. The so-called, I think they're called butterfly houses that you'll see in gardens are really decorative. They're really good for spiders, but they're not so good for butterflies. So they're more decorative, and that sort of, as you say, a trend of buying, a frenzy of buying goes on for these things, and they really don't work.
Okay, so they're very pretty, but
right,
not necessarily.
Very pretty. That's right.
Useful. And Suzanne is on the line from Grinnell with a related idea. Hi, Suzanne.
Oh, yeah. I was just reading about how to make a barn owl house.
Sure.
And I have a problem with our cats disappearing at one of our farms.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know whether barn owls or any other type of owls eat cats. I mean, I suspect coyotes too, but I just was curious what eats cats.
Well, anytime you have a cat running free, they can be subject, they're prey for lots of things, including great horned owls, coyotes, occasionally even foxes, although sometimes a big feral cat is the size of a small fox. So, but especially coyotes and great horned owls. Barn owls are very uncommon in Iowa. We do have a few of them, but they frequently get eaten themselves by great horned owls. Great horned owls are really the sort of the tigers of the woodlands. And you can put barn owl houses up. They're quite large, but they have to be, you have to really secure that entrance so things like raccoons cannot get to it, so that only the barn owls can. We found that that's the real critical thing with them.
And just speaking of barn owls, I mean, we talked about that recently, how they've really been out-competed in Iowa.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that people do want to do when they put up a house. They want to provide habitat for a species that is not as common with barn owl houses, considering all the other pressures. Would that work?
And probably not. It appears that Iowa DNR Wildlife Diversity Program for several years put up a whole series of them, and the results were really very, very mixed. You had to put them up in areas. There are so few around. They're not endangered across their whole range. In fact, that's a very wide-ranging species, clear into South America, in fact. But in Iowa and in much of the upper Midwest, they're not doing very well. And it appears that lack of cavities is not so much the problem as it is two other things, lack of prey. Certainly loss of barns doesn't help because it loses some habitat for them, but it's more loss of small rodent prey, and then certainly the change in habitat that has occurred, and it also appears that predation by great horned owls has been another thing, a serious problem for them. So something, just putting the house up doesn't guarantee that they're going to they're going to occupy it at all. Something else may, but perhaps not barn owls.
Right. So if you're looking, my takeaway is if you're looking for a surefire bed, you want to go with a birdhouse or a wren house.
Yeah, put up a wren house or a bluebird house and make sure that you choose the right location for them. You know, if you put a bluebird house too close to lots of shrubs, wrens are going to take it over. Bluebirds will not be able to take care of that. They're more of a savanna or prairie species than they are a woodland species. So you want to stay away from that. So.
All right. And we do have some other callers on the line as well. You're welcome to join our conversation with your suggestions at 866-780-9100. Kirk is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Kirk.
Hello. Thank you for this show. I love it all the time. And your timing is great. We have about an acre and a half in town here in Iowa City, half of which is woodland and half we're going to plant, and I'm making my order to Ion Exchange.
Great.
For prairie.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered what seeds might be optimal. They recommended a savanna woodland edge, and it has 50% wildflowers. If there's anything in particular we ought to plant, and if you could address the understory of the woodland area, what we might do there.
Sure. Understory of the woodland will, if it depends how degraded it is, but if it has things, look for things like honeysuckle or buckthorn or garlic mustard, all of which you can see this time of year. If you learn how to identify them, talk to your local county conservation board and naturalists, and they'll teach you how to identify them. In the winter, so you want to get rid of those things because they will outcompete everything else. So the woodland shore or woodland floor will take care of itself pretty much if you keep those other things out. There are lots of spring ephemerals, and Ion Exchange and other reputable dealers in the state will have some of the plants that you could put in there to help, everything from hepatica to the various woodland violets to bluebells, all kinds of native things that that go into a nice woodland floor. I think their suggestion for a savanna mix would be a really good mix. And you want to go heavy on the forbs. That's F-O-R-B-S. Those are the so-called showy flowering plants. with some grasses for sure, but make sure you have a very heavy mix of forbs.
And why is that?
They're more expensive, but they do provide seed heads for lots and lots of things to eat, everything from small mammals to birds. And they tend to be, particularly if you're in the city, they're a little showier, and people accept that a lot easier as well. So it sounds like a nice mix. And Ion Exchange is one of those nice, reputable dealers, good folks to deal with.
All right. Well, Kirk, thank you so much for your call. And what's next, Jim?
Let's talk a little bit about binoculars for both kids and adults. If you're beginning to get outdoors, there's nothing like a pair of binoculars to bring things up close and personal. And you want to learn how to use them for sure. But let's say, what is it that you want to look for? One is, I would go no larger, for most beginners, a 7x35. They come in various sizes. Some people will immediately, they'll look in the catalogs and say, oh boy, I can get a 10 power here. 10 power, it makes it very hard to find whatever it is you're looking at, because it's so powerful. It has a very narrow field of vision. So you want to go with a 7x35 millimeter. It's called 7x35s. You could go 8x40s or something like that, but really I'd really recommend a 7x35, and get the best ones you can afford. I had lots and lots of fairly cheap binoculars for many years because I couldn't afford anything better. But boy, once I got a pair of more expensive ones, I probably bought, I don't know, 10 pairs of cheap ones when I could have made one pair of more expensive ones last me really well. In binoculars, you do get what you pay for. So get the best ones you can possibly afford, but stay in the 7x35 range.
But if your kids treat them like my kids treat them, maybe don't invest yet.
Yeah, well, there is that. Yeah, you don't want to invest too heavily in that. You have problems with that?
A little bit, yeah. We go through binoculars like they're candy, I think.
Oh, yeah, but yeah. Well, so there are some fairly inexpensive ones on the market that still give you decent ocular quality. They won't withstand a drop in a stream or swinging around and hitting a tree necessarily, but they'll do for a while anyway. So.
All right. So are there any, you know, I know that people like to sell these. Yeah, of course, toy companies just love to sell.
Right.
But you do see these little things for kids to catch bugs in, and, you know, and they come with the whole kit and set. Do you know about any of those things that maybe are better than the mason jar that we used to use? Is there anything out there that's actually a really good investment along those lines?
There's some neat of those sort of pop-up cages where you can temporarily, and I stress the temporary part, this is a great time, a great way to also teach sort of ethical relationships to nature. I mean, kids are natural collectors, but capturing even insects and putting them in a jar to slowly die of asphyxiation, it's not a good thing to teach necessarily. But so there are these sort of pop-open cages that they're sort of, I don't know how to describe them. They're like cylinders made out of cheesecloth or made out of...
just a mesh.
A mesh.
It's almost like a spring.
Right, exactly. And it springs open. And it's a great place to watch chrysalises develop into butterflies, and then you can release the butterfly. It's a great place to keep lightning beetles temporarily so you get to watch them and then release them. Again, it's a kind of thing that is cool to do. And... can really get kids up close and personal with nature. Like I say, they're natural collectors, so encourage that. I was, I think one of the reasons that I'm doing what I'm doing today is that I was I could have been a geologist too, because I was a great rock collector as a kid, and I'm always amazed. I'm always happy when my grandkids say, "Ooh, that's a cool rock," because I go, "Ooh, yes, it is." So it's a neat thing to help kids do that kind of collecting.
All right. And we have a break coming up in just a couple of minutes, but what's next?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about books and other things that I think are great gifts for people. If you're going to gift wildlife, we've talked about habitat, we've talked about backyard feeding, binoculars, even a little bit about prairie seed and those kinds of things. So let's talk about some of the things for people that will help them understand and get closer to nature.
All right. And before we get to the break, let's Matt from Atlantic has a suggestion. Hi, Matt. Oh, we just lost him. Matt's suggestion was buying hunting or fishing licenses for people in your life. And his argument was that that supports wildlife in wild areas
in
Iowa.
It sure does. In fact, only 8% of the DNR's budget comes from the general fund. The rest of it, the vast majority of it, comes from licenses and fees that they pay. So if you don't hunt or fish, by buying that license or buying that duck stamp, the federal duck stamp program, all that money comes back and goes directly into wildlife.
All right. And we will take our break. We'll get back to talking about books, organizations, and even apps here in just a moment with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about ways that you can give to nature, or ways that you can give gifts that indulge someone else's love for nature and wild places, or ways that you can foster a love and respect for nature in children on your gift list this year. We'd love to hear from you as well. If there's a book or a couple of books that you read as a child or you read with your children who really, really ignited their imagination and their love for nature, let us know what that book is. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa, iowapublicradio.org. I'm here today with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here with wildlife biologist Jim Pease today, and we're talking about ways to give to nature or gifts that foster a love of nature this holiday season. 866-780-9100 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we were just getting into books, Jim.
Right. Let me start with a couple that for kids that I think are particularly wonderful. You'll have to forgive me because I don't have young kids anymore, but I do browse the children's library shelves, and there are lots of good things coming out all the time. But these are a couple of old time favorites. One of my all time favorites is Owl Moon. I don't think that you should get through childhood without having exposure to Owl Moon. You must read that to your children as well.
Oh yes, definitely. And that's by Jane Yolen, and
right.
It's just a wonderful story about a little girl going out with her father at night. A cold winter night to go find owls.
You bet. And it reminds me of a book that is out of print now, but I think it's a great reminder for adults. It was called Walk When the Moon Is Full, and it's about that very experience. Is make sure it's one of the things I think the gift that a parent can give to a child is a gift certificate for one night a month, a walk at night in the full moon. Doesn't matter whether it's winter or summer or whenever, go out on that full moon. And if you go on the same path all the time, it's amazing the things you'll discover, not only because you're there at night, but also because you're there in different seasons. You'll get to know that path very, very well. And don't need flashlights or anything. The moon provides the light for you. So Owl Moon is a story of one of those walks anyway. There's another one called Tales, which is all about animal tales, T-A-I-L-E-S, by Van Fleet is the, I don't remember the author's first name. There's a book that I've discovered called Urban Roosts, Where Birds Nest in the City. It's fairly modern book. I would say it came out, I don't remember what year it came
1992.
Out. 92, okay. So it's a nice book. The Great Kapok Tree, if you're into tropics, it's a wonderful book for middle-aged kids. And then, of course, the original, not the movie version, but the original Lorax by Dr. Seuss is just a wonderful thing. There are also some books by one of my favorite authors and a friend, Douglas Wood, out of Minnesota. Probably Old Turtle is the one that he's most famous for and actually is my favorite. He's written some that I don't care for as much, but I really like Old Turtle in particular. And then he also did Granddad's Prayers for the Earth, which are both by Douglas Wood. And those are kids' books that I think are really good. And there are just a host of other ones. We could do nothing but kids' books for an hour here about nature that are really, really cool.
Absolutely. But Jim, when you were a kid, what did you read that really took you out there?
Jack London.
Call of the Wild.
Oh, Call of the Wild, you bet, and White Fang and all those things. And boy, you know, you look back on them, I read parts of White Fang to a fifth grade class a few years ago, and I realized, boy, after reading it, it was a really violent book. But I don't remember the violence. What I remember, of course, is the dog, and it really solidified I had dogs ever since I was a little kid, and of course, it made dogs and the wildness in them very, very important to me. So I thought that was a good one. There are also some great books about kids alone in the wilderness that you mentioned to me earlier.
Right. The one that I read again and again as a kid was Julie of the Wolves by Jean Craighead George.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, not only is that a wonderful story for a girl to, you know, think about being independent and wild, but it also introduces you to all kinds of fascinating wolf behavior and
you bet.
And really great stuff. And I read a mixture of fiction and nonfiction my mom would read out loud to us. There was a wonderful book called God's Dog by Hope Ryden that's out of print now, but you should find it anyway. And it's about coyotes, and she lived in the wilderness. She calls herself a bedroll naturalist, and she lived with next to a den of coyotes for an entire season and reported all that she saw. And so bringing those two things together really took me out there. And of
Hatchet
course, we were
too?
Living it at the same time. Yeah, Hatchet by Gary Paulson, which was,
wonderful.
I read it as an adult. It came out when I was a teenager, but
sure.
It is a wonderful book living in the wilderness.
I know a lot of teachers are using that as a reading book in their classrooms now, and I'm so happy to see that because it really is a terrific children's book about kids in the outdoors. And there are also a number of kids' magazines that are available. Both National Geographic and the National Wildlife Federation have kids' magazines. National Geographic Explorer is a great children's magazine, and so is National Wildlife Federation has both Big Backyard for younger kids and then Ranger Rick for older kids.
Which almost all of us grew up on those,
you
I think.
Bet. Yeah, great stuff. Great stuff.
All right. I want to get a couple of callers in here. Amy's on the line. Hi, Amy.
Yes, hello.
Hi, what's your suggestion?
My suggestion is a fairly new book in last two or three years called Evolution of Calpurnia Tate. It's about a girl who, during the time of when Darwin first started writing his works, her grandfather was a correspondent with Darwin, and so she became a great naturalist, and about how all of her family except her grandfather really pushed against her doing that. She needed to be, you know, a traditional girl. And so it's a really, really fabulous book.
Do you know,
kids have read it a couple of times.
Who's the author? She's the author?
No,
it's Jacqueline Kelly is the author. And that was a Newbery Award winner in 2010.
Yes.
So it's a fairly recent book. And grade level fourth grade and up is what it's listed at.
Yep.
Oh, well, thank you. What a great suggestion.
Terrific. That's great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Amy.
Yeah. Bye.
All right. Thanks a lot. And Steve is on the line next from Cambridge. Hi, Steve.
Yes.
Hi. What's your suggestion?
The Man-Eaters of Cremone by Colonel Jim Corbett. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Man-eating tigers in India at the turn of the last century.
Wow.
And he wrote a series of books of where he hunted these tigers that had killed hundreds of people by foot so that he would get the right tiger.
This sounds bedtime reading is quite exciting.
Up at night.
Yeah,
this was made into a movie a few years ago too, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check that out.
All right, I think that it was, but so this would be, you think, what, for teenagers or?
I read it when I was in the fifth grade.
Oh wow!
Wow.
I got the book from the Linden Public Library, and then we moved, and I forgot to take the book back. And I have it 40 years later. I guess I shouldn't have said anything.
Well, we won't give your last name on the radio
your
here.
Your fines are going to be exorbitant for that. Well, Steve, thanks a lot for your call.
That's great.
Okay, bye.
Bye. And Jim, you also have some apps that you really like as
well,
right?
I tell you, I at the risk of revealing my lack of technological savvy, my wife has an iPad, okay, and I have to tell you that there are some great apps now available that people who have a tablet, and I'm most familiar, of course, with the Mac versions, but there are versions of these for other tablets as well. One of our all-time favorites is one called Skywalk, and this is an app that has the night sky in it, and it automatically, because it's on your iPad, it has a GPS built in, so it automatically adjusts the sky for where you are. So we've taken it to the southwest, we've taken it to the north, right here in Iowa as well. You put it on, and it shows the constellations overhead, and as you adjust it, as you turn, it turns, so that it always keeps oriented in the proper direction, so you can it outlines constellations for you. It tells you where the planets are, what stage the moon is in, et cetera, et cetera. So you can identify. You say, is that a star or a planet? And you hold the Skywalk up over your head and you say, oh, wow, that's Saturn. It's just an amazing little app. So Skywalk, and there are a bunch of other ones, but that's our favorite. We've seen some of the other ones. We don't think they're quite as good. And then there are a whole series of guides that are available. The Sibley's, my favorite bird book is now the Sibley's A Guide to North American Birds, and David Sibley's Bird Guide. Then there are a whole series of Audubon guides. The reason they make wonderful apps is that they have on them the sounds that they make as well, so that you're not just, in bird sounds, you usually get these sonograms, which, unless you're a scientist and know how to read them, mean absolutely nothing, to most people who have the book. But the app has an actual sound. Now, here, for example, is from the Audubon Mammal Guide to Mammals in North America. It has 459 species. Here is the sound of the North American... That's an otter. I don't know if you could hear that very well. North American river otter. There are all sorts of sounds
on
here.
Kind of squeaky.
Yeah, kind of squeaky is right. And that squeaky sound, we were just watching a Christmas Vacation the other night. So you could have squirrel sounds as well. So there are all kinds of sounds. And the thing about apps and putting them on a tablet is that you have those sounds. You say, well, gee, I thought I heard a bobcat last night. I wonder what bobcats actually sound like. And you can go to this app and actually have it there in front of you. Or you can be standing in the field and say, gee, is that a whippoorwill or a chuckwill's widow? And you can call up both of them and say, oh, no, it sounds more like a chuckwill's widow. That would be really really cool to hear. The apps are really wonderful things. So they're Ottoman guides, and they have them to wildflowers and marine mammals and all kinds of things if you really want to get into them.
And do they have sounds in different situations, like raccoon fight?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what they have. Yeah, and that's really the neat thing about it, I think, is that they really have. They don't have all the sounds that are possible. Certainly, it would be very difficult to do. But they do have, for some species, they have several different sounds, and in several different parts of the United States, because there are dialectical differences, particularly in birds in different parts of the United States. So there are some really cool things that you can get for the electronically inclined.
Well, and David and Grinnell sent us an email with another book, Where the Red Fern Grows, which is another book that takes you into nature, although, boy, that's such a tearjerker.
It is.
It's really hard to get through.
Yeah, it is. But it's a very, very excellent, excellent book.
Well, I wanted to mention another one that's a favorite of mine, and it's a recent book. It's called Tom's Tree by Gillian Shields. And it's a very simple picture book, but it's about a little boy who decides that he's going to plant a tree, and his big brother makes fun of him for planting the tree. And they, forget about it. And then the next spring, it comes up. And so his whole life, he protects this tree, but he grows, of course, much faster than the tree. But in the end of the book, he comes back with his son on his shoulders, and they look at this tree together. And
that's great.
And of course, the tree will live a very long time. And that's just, it's a wonderful book. It's Tom's Tree by Gillian Shields.
Great.
And a very gentle way to talk about that with your kids.
Right. That's great. That's great.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. I think we have time for probably one more call before we run out of time today. Stanley's on the line from Fayette. Hey, Stanley.
Hi. I'd like to say one of the best books purchased for my wife and mother. It was a book of birds just on Iowa. And they really enjoyed that so much, and my mom always took so many notes. And one of the birds she really was upset was with the blue jay. And if you read her notes, how they is always running off other birds, and she had more notes on the blue jay about being mean than any other bird in the book.
All right. Yeah, there's some great books specific to Iowa. There's a wonderful series of things that if you want to learn about Iowa, they're are put out by the Iowa Association of Naturalists. They're available. They're called the IAN, Iowa Association of Naturalists Publications, and there are a whole series of 40 of them on Iowa available through your county extension office.
And, I think that that's a great suggestion, because we do tend to overlook the nature of Iowa. Not you,
right.
Jim.
No. I look over it.
Right. But many of us do think, well, we don't have Great Lakes and we don't have mountains.
Right.
We don't have deep, dark forests. Right. But we do have a lot of beautiful places here.
There's a lot here, and there are a lot of great organizations doing great work here, too. And that's another thing to do, is to support those organizations. Organizations like the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, the Iowa Wildlife Center, Nature Conservancy, local county conservation board, friends groups, or other wild areas in your county. All of those groups want and need support. And, a great alternative is giving a gift in somebody's name to one of those organizations that supports Iowa wild places and wildlife. So I really hope that the people will consider that as they look for gifts to give back to the wild this year.
Well, Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And happy holidays.
Same to you.
Jim Pease, wildlife biologist, he joins us once a month to talk about Iowa's wildlife and wild places. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry, with technical support from Jason Burns in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, best music of 2012 with Mark Simmet and Bob Doerr. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.